Washington Court of Appeal, Division 1, is now accepting the Honorable Linda Lau presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Please be seated. All right. Parties ready in the first matter, Toff versus Spratt?
Yes, Your Honor.
Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Certainly.
May it please the Court, Andrew Kinsler here on behalf of Brad and Jill Toft on a special motion to strike Ms. Spratt's defamation claims against the Tofts under the anti-SLAPP statute RCW 4.24.510. The issue presented is whether Ms. Spratt has presented clear and convincing evidence in the record below of a probability of prevailing on each element of her defamation claim. Before I get into the elements of the claim, I want to talk for a moment about the constitutionality of the process that we're engaged in, because it was addressed in some detail in the prior opinion when we were here last November, and I want to make sure the Court is aware of what has occurred since then. In the prior opinion, the Court went to great lengths to explain that Ms. Spratt had discovery rights and that should she choose to use them, and gave the trial court very clear direction on that point. In fact, the record that we have is now the same as it was when we were here 4 or 5 months ago. Ms. Spratt chose not to conduct any additional discovery and has not provided any additional evidence for the record. We're in the same place we were before with respect to the record. I don't mean that in any way criticism. I'm just pointing out the fact that the court made clear that there were discovery rights, and Ms. Spratt had whatever opportunity she wanted to gain additional discovery to build the record further, which has not been done. So we now then are presented with the question of, is there a clear and convincing evidence of a probability that she can prevail on each claim of her defamation, each element of her defamation claim? And I'm going to address, we've addressed all the elements in the briefing in detail. I'm going to talk this morning about two elements, and that is, the first element is, was there a false and defamatory statement that is actionable? And secondly, is there evidence of proximate cause of damages? Because each of these elements are fatal to her claim. The first question is falsity. And the courts have made clear that it is not enough to come forward with a false statement. The false statement must be materially false. And the Mark case demonstrates the tension between the First Amendment and defamation law. We have a case that involves political speech. We have an interaction that occurred in a campaign stop. And so we have political speech protected by the First Amendment and a defamation claim. And the Mark case talked about the fact that the statement that is under attack need be more than false. It must be materially false and defamatory. And then we're in a circle of a defamation claim. The statement has to be defamatory. What does that mean? And it must, and the Mark case talked about this at page 493, 96 Washington 2nd, 473 at page 493. And the statement must, the substance of the statement makes substantial danger to the reputation of the plaintiff apparent. The statement must make substantial danger to the reputation of the plaintiff apparent. So what are we talking about here? We're talking about Mr. Toft explaining, this person is attacking me at a campaign stop. Why? Because I fired her 6 years ago in an employment relationship. She says that statement was false. But as we talked about last November, I've provided the court with Ms. Spratt's declaration, paragraph 13 of that declaration, her version of the events. She went into Mr. Toft's office and tendered her resignation to be effective in 2 weeks. He was furious with her. He yelled for a moment, asking her how she could give up so much money, then told me my resignation was going to be effective immediately and I should leave the building at once, which I did. Mr. Toft says, I fired her. She says, I resigned. We can see where both of them come in terms of their views of this. He told her to leave immediately. She said she resigned. Now, I think it's telling to read the appellant's brief. So in other words, that's not a false statement. He says, I told her to leave immediately. I fired her. It's not a false statement. I think it's important to see the light in which Ms. Spratt wants to place this. At page 11 of her brief, she says the goal of Mr. Toff's statement was to cast her in a poor light. And then I'm going to quote page 11 of her brief. To degrade the impact of Ms. Spratt's objections to Mr. Toff's candidacy. To degrade the impact of Mr. Spratt's objections to Mr. Toff's candidacy. And then she goes on to say, that is the very essence of defamation. That's wrong. The essence of defamation is not in a campaign stop. People are arguing over the effectiveness of their rhetoric and whatever bias they might have. That's not the essence of defamation. The essence of defamation is you're trying to destroy someone's reputation in the community, not a give and take in a campaign stop. Secondly, saying that someone was fired is not defamatory. As a matter of law, it's not defamatory. There's nothing defamatory. We're an at-will state. People can be fired for any number of reasons. Now, there's some give and take that could then go on as to why that happened, and that's appropriate in the give and take of the political hubbub. It is not appropriate for a lawsuit over campaign, the rough and tumble of the campaign give and take. The anonymous letter is just that, anonymous, and it has nothing but opinions. Finally, with respect to damages, there's absolutely, we do not have a defamation per se case. There must be proof of special damages. There is no proof of special damages in this case. All of this evidence was within Ms. Spratt's control. She brought none of it forward. This case does not belong in the courtroom. It belongs in the ballot box. This was a campaign disagreement. This was attack and counterattack in a campaign. The anti-SLAPP statute is designed to protect public participation from the courtroom. Public participation, whether you be the candidate or whether you be the opponent, is protected by the anti-SLAPP statute to say no one does this in the courtroom. They do it in the ballot box. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Janet Irons, and I'm here today representing Kelly Spratt, who's in the courtroom with her husband today. There are two issues before the Court today. First, the defamation issue itself, whether Ms. Spratt has shown by clear and convincing evidence all the elements of a defamation claim. And secondly, was the renewed anti-SLAPP motion brought by Mr. and Mrs. Toft frivolous so that Ms. Spratt is in fact entitled to recover her attorney's fees. And the law does indicate that all inferences need to be made in favor of Ms. Spratt, the non-moving party. Let me first address something that Mr. Counselor relied very heavily on, that is the declaration of Mrs. Spratt, where she indicated that she had given notice that she was resigning due to Mr. Toft's abuse, that when she informed Mr. Toft, he instructed her to leave the building. But that was not simply firing someone, and that wasn't simply the end of his statement. In fact, Mr. Toft also sent emails that clarified that situation well beyond what Mr. Kinsler just referenced. Specifically, Mr. Toft's email to Ramsey Boutros, dated March 16, 2012, Mr. Toff stated, quote, with regards to Kelly Spratt, she was fired by me and two board members 7 years ago from the JV that I managed for the very behavior she exhibited tonight. Her story about giving 2 weeks' notice was a lie. So he's not saying that she quit, gave 2 weeks' notice, and then he told her not to stay and that was firing. He is specifically saying to third parties, he fired her for cause. She did not resign. He's saying that she's a liar, when in fact all the evidence that's been submitted indicate she did in fact voluntarily quit. We have a copy of her employment record saying she voluntarily resigned because of Mr. Toft. There's a statement from Randy Smith, the regional supervisor, saying that she resigned to him because of Mr. Toft's behavior and that he apologized and she was rehired subsequently. And then we have this email that Mr. Toft sent himself saying that she was fired for cause and never gave 2 weeks' notice. Mr. Kinsler's spin simply does not reflect the facts that were before the trial court and which are before this court. Defamation requires, first of all, falsity, and that evidence is before the court, and it was not presented at a campaign stop. The evidence...
Is it a jury question as to whether it's materially false?
A question of fact. I would submit there's clear and convincing evidence that it is overwhelming evidence.
How would the jury be instructed to determine the materiality of the falsity?
To determine the material.
It doesn't seem here that oftentimes what we're dealing with is a dispute as to what actually happened on God's earth, and we give people the benefits of what happened at this stage of the proceeding. Here, there doesn't seem to be a dispute as to what actually happened, but there appears to be a dispute about what it means.
And
she's not disputing. He said, "You got to leave today. You got to get out." He's not. Presumably, he's not disputing that she claims that her assertion is that she resigned and that she was other than the part you read, but in the briefing. So, how does the court instruct the jury to determine the question of the materiality of this of the falsity of the views on this exchange?
Actually, what Mr. Kinstler has attempted to do today is to narrow the representations made by Mr. and Mrs. Toff to a very narrow range of one statement. And in fact, there are a number of statements in different contexts, several of which are in writing, that contradict what Mr. Kinstler said here today. And it's that entire body of material that the jury would be asked to look at to determine if it was in fact a material misrepresentation. And it went not just to the employment relationship and who was at fault in that, but outright calling Ms. Spratt a liar, the anonymous letter that the computer expert indicates includes material that was uniquely available to Mrs. Toff.
Here's what I'm trying to work through in my mind, though, is we've got one cause of action, defamation, cause of action.
Mm-hmm.
We've got different groupings of fact that, if believed, tend to prove the cause of action. We've got potentially, depending on how the jury were to sort through this, different tests that would apply to your client at the time that the statements were made. For instance, your client probably has a stronger argument that she was not a qualified public figure at the time of the first statement from Mr. Toft to the Republican person. Can't remember, Boutros.
Mr. Boutros, yeah. Yes.
Because she had not yet spoken in a meeting. By the time of the anti-harassment order, months later, whatever was said, her argument that she had not become any type of a public figure is likely weaker at that time because there had been so many exchanges. So without deciding whether it was true or not, the jury would have this. So how they perceived her at that time would also apply to the resolution of what facts they had to find. So I'm at the very beginning, the first exchange where your client's position is the strongest with regard to not being a public figure seems to be the focus of what counsel was arguing with regard to the fired or not fired in that exchange. And I'm just wondering how the jury would sort through that if they agreed that what everybody had been saying was true. How would they determine whether any falsity was material?
Well, in fact, they're not agreeing on the salient facts. Mr. Toft has specifically said her story about giving 2 weeks' notice was a lie. He claims that he unilaterally fired her, one would assume, over her objection.
Well, but let's say the jury believed that that was so, that she did give 2 weeks' notice and that her intention was. I have law clerks that work for me. They have a time period that they're going to work, and then they're going to leave. One of them comes to me and says, "I got this great job, but I got to leave you a month early in order to take it." And I say, "We had a deal. You're fired. Leave today." She might believe that she was informing me of a resignation a month early. I might believe that I had just fired her. If the jury believed that both of us had said the things that we said, how would they determine the materiality of any falsity?
If that was the situation, it would be distinct from this, because we do have Mr. Toft in writing saying that she did not give 2 weeks' notice.
Let's assume that the jury believes that she did.
Yes.
Let's assume that the jury believes she intended to leave and she was giving 2 weeks' notice, and the jury also believed that that infuriated him and he therefore fired her immediately.
Yes.
Let's assume the jury believes that those are the facts. How do they determine what's false and what's material about the falsity?
Well, the weighing of the falsity would depend on them observing the witnesses and the evidence that was put into the court.
Well, let's say they did that and they believed that both things were true. So what I'm getting at is normally we give inferences about what actually happened, but here the jury could believe that both of those things happened. If they did believe that both of those things happened, that she came in, gave 2 weeks' notice, and he said, you're fired, you got to leave today, how would they determine what's false and whether what's false is material?
Well, first of all, they'd be given, one assumes, a copy of this email where he said that, in fact, she didn't give 2 weeks' notice and that she's a liar. That's actually those are his words. So with respect to the court, they could not find both stories correct.
Well, they could find that she intended to resign and gave 2 weeks' notice, and also find that she told him that, and he told her, you're fired today, leave today. They could believe that both of those things were true. So he believes he fires her, she believes she resigned. So how does the jury resolve the question as the materiality of a falsity from his statement that he fired her?
And you can tell, Your Honor, I'm struggling with your question, because I don't believe it's possible to reconcile the two, because Mr. Todd.
No, I think you should come to terms with this if you want to meet 12 registered voters. Because I think it's entirely possible that a jury could view these things, all of these things, as being true.
And believe they were both telling the truth?
And believe that, yes.
Or believe they both believed they were telling the truth?
She's telling the truth when she says, I intend to resign, and here's 2 weeks' notice. And he's telling the truth when he says, I told her, you're fired today, leave the office today. He thinks he fired her, she thinks she resigns.
But how
could the jury not find that both of those things could be true? I mean, obviously they could find that both of those things could be true.
They could find both of those things.
So then what do they do with it if they do? How do they determine falsity and materiality?
They have to look at the rest of the body of the evidence and the circumstances under which Mr. Toft expanded and contracted his stories and Mrs. Toft's, including the anonymous letter that was sent out that alluded to the undisclosed defamatory statements that resulted in the conclusion that Mrs. Spratt should not be around young people. And there is, in fact, a case in Washington that addresses that, Dunlap versus Wayne, that says undisclosed defamatory facts that are used to form the basis of an opinion can, in fact, be actionable at law.
I think you've answered the question.
Pardon?
I think you've answered the question. Has she not, Judge Fuller?
I'm fine with it.
Thank you. As I indicated, there's also the employment record that indicated that she voluntarily resigned, and the declaration from Mr. Smith. I would like to briefly touch on the two claims of privilege that are addressed in the appellant's brief but not referenced this morning in oral argument. Limited public figure and also common interest. And with regard to common interest, I'd ask the court to look to the declaration of Mr. Boutros. I'm sorry?
I think the clock went off, so I think your time is up.
I have 2 minutes and 32 seconds, according to this clock.
Well, no, it's my mistake.
Oh.
The clock went off.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was watching this.
It's okay. I was listening and wasn't
okay. I would ask the court to affirm the lower court and to consider award of fees to Ms. Spratt because of the frivolous nature of the appeal. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't you offer your view on the question that I had in the exchange with counsel. If the jury were to assume that for the jury's truth, she intended to resign, she announced she was resigning, and she was giving 2 weeks' notice, he heard that for whatever reason. He was outraged, whatever. He said, no, you're leaving today, you're fired today. The jury were to believe that that was what actually happened. How would it sort through falsity and the materiality of falsity?
Because the element of fault, the third element, in the defamation is with respect to a non-defamatory per se statement, is there has to be fault on the part of the defendant. If the defendant reasonably believes that the statement is true and the jury says, we think the defendant believes the statement is true, then it doesn't meet the test of defamation. It doesn't, the fault element is not present, and there must be a verdict for the defendant. I also think, with respect to the materiality issue, that is not a question of fact for the jury. That is the gatekeeper function that the courts have said in this tension between the First Amendment right to free speech in the political hurly-burly and the right to protect your reputation, that the courts must undertake, even in the absence of the anti-SLAPP statute, the courts have to undertake an inquiry in a defamation claim as to what is there really clear and convincing evidence of falsity that and materiality that should allow this to go forward. And that's what's missing here. There's nothing materially false in their claims. She doesn't like the fact that her attack was rebutted, but there's nothing materially false. I would like to address for a moment the conundrum that was pointed out by Judge Gross in the prior opinion in this case at page 632. He noted a conundrum and an absurdity, he said, that if Mr. Toft were bringing the claim, Ms. Spratt would probably have an anti-SLAPP motion against him. And that seems sort of absurd. And my point is, it's not absurd at all. It's exactly what the legislature intended, which was these disputes are resolved in the ballot box. They're not resolved in the courtroom. Don't bring your lawsuits about your campaign disputes into court. If you do, you're subject to anti-SLAPP. We're going to look at it carefully. We're going to protect the right of public participation of both sides. And if either side brings that claim, they're subject to the anti-SLAPP dismissal of their claim. I would ask that the court find that this claim should be dismissed, that the claim has not been brought forward with clear and cogent evidence, and that this matter should end here. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.